gloves against the stone wall of the fireplace. Will they all get the consumption?
Likely. It's a bad thing. They can cough and spit blood for years. It's hardly ever curable.
They put a handful of beans in the boiling water and added a bit of salt pork from the attic. The rich smell moved through the rooms of the house, warming and cheering their battered feelings, giving them a small degree of comfort. They made their rounds of the shopkeepers and came away with a wagon load of potatoes, turnips, beef tallow, lard, and cornmeal, heaped on until they had to be careful not to throw anything off. Joe and Bessie were grateful, the children overjoyed. Two of the toddlers were coughing, so Hester left some of the same tincture with instructions for Bessie. A week before Christmas, when the women were knitting gifts and green boughs and holly berries decorated the mantel, there was a sharp rap on the front door. Then another. Buppy moved quickly down the short hallway. A gust of icy air moved across the floor. Hester heard Buppy's low voice. When she closed the door, she sighed, relieved the visitor had gone. But then she held her breath as heavy footfalls followed Buppy's lighter ones. She looked up. A white-coated liveryman stood in their kitchen. Tall, dark of face, his eyes light with a greenish flash like a trout in a forest pool. His face was trimmed by a neat beard, a mustache above his lips. He saw Hester in the gray afternoon light, crackling fire casting her face in an ethereal golden glow. Her eyes were large and dark, her mouth slightly open, revealing her perfect white teeth, her long, slender neck reminding him of a swan. He forgot where he was and his errand. Buppy cleared her throat, which severed the spell efficiently.
I beg your pardon. You must be Hester Zook?
King.
Hester King? Yes, I'm employed by the Breckenridges on King Street. Their daughter is indisposed. They have heard of the Amish women and the herbs they have knowledge of. Would you be so kind as to accompany me?
Immediately, Hester was on her feet. The liveryman was amazed at her height. He had never encountered such charm, such innocent beauty.
Allow me a minute for my shawl.
Her voice was like the call of the whippoorwill, a babbling brook, the trill of a bluebird, the wind in the fir trees. Hester had acquired a black bag, which she filled with labeled bottles, all in order, side by side, along with clean strips of muslin, scissors, a knife, and any small utensil she thought she might need. As she followed him down to the grand carriage, her heart swelled within her, recognizing this venture for what it was, a dream, a passion. When he opened the door for her, he saw her face was completely hidden by her large black hat. He wanted to grab the wide black strings and rake it off her head. He mourned the loss of her face. He sat outside, up high, while she sat alone, Buppy having opted to stay indoors and finish her knitting. Hester stayed hidden, afraid someone from their church district would see her being borne away to the wealthy section of town. With the stern reprimand of Bishop Joel Stoltzfus still weighing heavily on her conscience, she shrank back against the luxurious cushions. The carriage stopped. Hester waited. When the door opened, the white-coated man stood directly in her line of vision, his eyes intense, eager. She shrank from his too familiar look. She lowered her eyes and brushed past him, seeming to skim the steps in her haste to reach the front door. He mourned the loss of her. She mourned the fact that some things never change. The brass ring slipped in her hand and crashed against the red door with a splintering sound. Quickly, the door swung open from the inside. A short, buxom woman stood aside, her graying hair piled on top of her head in artificial poofs, containing so many glittering combs her hair seemed to be alive.
"Oh, you've come! You've come! Miranda!"
She called quite loudly for a lady of her stature, but was quickly rewarded by the heavy pounding of steps from the wide oak staircase directly in front of her. Hester gave Miranda the black shawl and hat. Hester's fingers moved restlessly on the black handle of her satchel. Her heart beat loudly in her ears as her eyes took in the sheer grandeur of this house. The stairway was almost as big as Heinz Hoffman's whole house.
The foyer, the hallway with the adjoining library and receiving room, would hold 5 or 6 of the poor hovels. She had not known that wallpaper existed. Flowers and leaves and birds on a wall were unthinkable. How did they get there on that paper? How did the scrolls of paper get stuck to the walls?
Are you listening?
The woman's voice came from far away.
Oh, yes, yes, of course. I am Cassandra Breckenridge. I am pleased to make your acquaintance. I gather you are Hester King?
Yes. My daughter is very sick. The doctors are puzzled.
Hester nodded.
You may follow me.
Hester followed at a polite distance, the brilliantly flowered skirt bobbing up the stairs ahead of her, the ruffles sweeping the dust carefully as she moved. A white hand with 4 short, fat fingers trailed along the gleaming banister, each one circled by jeweled rings, either gold or what she supposed were diamonds. She had never seen diamonds or any precious stones, so how would she know? The room they entered was a vision of pink tulle and huge, puffy roses on the wallpaper, as if someone had dreamed of this room and placed it here. The bed was high and deep and wide, the coverlet of white as pure as snow. The girl reclining on the pillow was short and round-faced like her mother. Her hair resembled spun gold, with waves that reminded Hester of a pool of water when the wind disturbed it. Her face was flushed, her blue eyes bright with fever, the lids drooping with the weariness of the sick. A tall glass of water stood on the round-skirted table by her bed, next to a box that held what Hester supposed were confections, a new sweet Buppy had spoken of, which the English brought across the ocean from their home country.
Cynthia, this is Hester. She is a plain lady from the Amish. She has herbal decoctions to make you better.
A look of sulfuric, hissing blue was cast in Hester's direction. The pink lips blossomed prettily into a pout of steely rebellion.
I won't take it.
Instantly, a fluttering and whining began, a tearful pleading that led to hysteria, the mother hovering and bowing as she begged.
Won't do it!
Hester stood, waiting till the mother settled down. Finally, she said,
tell her where it hurts. No! Darling girl, oh, please, please, please obey your mother.
I want to talk to her, Hester said. Dipping and swaying, perspiring effusively, the mother settled herself on a chair, moaning softly to herself. Can you tell me? Hester ventured carefully.
My stomach.
Top or bottom? The girl widened her eyes, her eyebrows lowered as she pouted prettily.
It just hurts.
She allowed Hester to feel the swollen abdomen. What had the book said? The old grandmother. Hester felt the stomach, which was swollen a bit, but not hard. She needed to summon the courage to inquire of this wealthy woman, questions only a doctor should be asking. Hester drew down the girl's soft pink nightgown, replaced the covers, and gave her a gentle pat and a shy smile. Turning to the still moaning mother, she crossed her arms tightly below her chest and coughed lightly, self-consciously biding her time. She would not be able to ask of her a question so dubious, so personal. The delicate apparition on the chair had ceased to moan and had taken out a well-used crocheted handkerchief. Flinging it over her nose, she began a wailing that made Hester decide to speak before she brought more sickness to her poor daughter.
Mrs. Breckenridge, please don't.
From the bed, the fever-bright eyes turned toward the mother, and a sour expression came down over her face like a gray mottled cloud.
Oh, mother, shut up.
The words were spoken wearily and without respect, her spoiled face turning into a caricature of her mother's weeping one, before a triumphant smile stretched across her face. Does Cynthia have... Hester hesitated. Does she... Are her bowels loose? Hester's face flamed with embarrassment. These things simply were not spoken for anyone to hear, except perhaps a doctor. Immediately, the mother ceased her wet, sloppy crying and dabbed indelicately at her eyes, her head held to one side, alert.
I don't know.
From the bed came the angry,
How would you? You never empty the chamber pots. Miranda does. Honey, do you have, what she asked?
Indifferently, Cynthia shrugged her shoulders.
Ask Miranda. She knows.
With that, she flipped on her side. Up came the covers over her fever-red face as she burrowed beneath them like a squirrel. Whimpering, the mother bustled out of the room, her shrill voice preceding her, calling the servant. She re-entered with the fast-breathing, portly Miranda in tow. Hester spent a few awkward moments, unsure of what she should do. Go to the bed and question the sick girl herself, or leave it to the housekeeper? She viewed the beautiful room with appreciative eyes again. She stroked the glossy top of a dresser to be sure it wasn't wet. How could anything wooden shine like that? Her hand dropped to her side as the mother disappeared out of the door with Miranda, and then just as quickly returned with her, urging her to speak.
Yes, yes, she do. She have the looseness. She sick. Her stomach not right. Course not. The doctor, what those doctors do? Nothing. They don't do nothing. They don't know what wrong with her.
Hester stood still. She saw the old Indian woman, her hand going to her stomach. She spoke of the pains, the things to take, so many different ones, so many herbs, and the matter of finding the right one. She was feverish, this young girl, which spoke of infection. Hester had listened closely as the old Indian woman spoke of the fermented juice of apples mixed with the salt she gathered at the salt licks by the waters. Her black eyes had snapped with enthusiasm, and she laughed a cracked, rough sound of triumph about the taste, but she had whispered to Hester the healing would not fail. She had never seen it fail. Going to Cynthia's bed, Hester gently peeled back the covers. If I bring some medicine, will you take it, even if it doesn't taste good?
No!
The scream was high-pitched, defiant, sure. If I mix it with juice?
No, the doctors all do that!
Again, Cassandra, the hovering mother, began picking at the pink coverlet, her voice pleading, cajoling, promising her sick daughter anything her heart desired, if only she would take what Hester asked.
No!
Miranda plucked at Hester's sleeve and led her out of the room. What do you need? Vinegar and salt.
I have both. Come with me.
Together, they moved down the wide staircase, back the wide, gleaming hallway, down another flight of stairs, and into a kitchen that seemed to have no end. A huge fireplace, two cook stoves, a deep sink with a drainer board on each side, and so many pans and pots and dishes, Hester could not imagine the uses for all of them. Miranda moved to the far wall, opened a wide door to a pantry lined with shelves, and got down a jug. Vinegar. Hester found the salt, measured it, then poured in the vinegar, enough to make a liquid. Miranda's round brown eyes searched Hester's face.
You'll not do the young miss harm.
No, this will not harm her. Miranda lowered her voice, held a palm against the side of her cheek, and whispered,
That little miss is full of worms, that's what. She eats sugar all the time. Breakfast, cookies. Dinner, pie. All day long.
Hester smiled. This will help.
How are you getting it in her?
I think she'll take it.
They
passed two African girls lugging baskets of clothes, their hair done with dozens of colorful ribbons within their braids. They were pretty, their faces wreathed in smiles as they met Miranda. When Hester and Miranda entered the room, the scene had not changed, except for Cassandra's elevated hysterics, her daughter a lump beneath the covers, unresponsive. Hester felt her patience snap. Everyone leave the room, she barked in a voice that carried well, brought the mother's face astonished toward her, and sent Miranda scuttling from the room, her black eyes rolling in her head, the whites showing her fear and respect for this tall, dark woman.
I will not leave,
Cassandra said, her face a solid mask of resolve. Your daughter will not live then. Hester placed the bottle and spoon by the bed, picked up her black satchel,
and prepared to leave.
Instantly, two fat white hands fluttered in her direction.
I'll go. Only please, please don't hurt my darling. Don't make her do anything she doesn't want to.
Hester's answer was a steely gaze. Slowly, the mother backed from the room, a hand to her heaving chest, another going to her trembling mouth. As soon as the door closed behind her, Hester turned, flung off the covers, and said,
"Sit up." "No."
Firmly, Hester grabbed the girl's shoulders, turned her, and sat her up. Keeping her hands on her arms, she lowered her face, her dark eyes compelling, and said only one sentence in a voice to be feared. "You have a badly infected stomach." Cynthia nodded, wide-eyed with fear. "Take this." Pouring out a measure, she put it to the girl's mouth. Keeping her hand on her forearm, she held it against her lips. When Cynthia turned her head away, Hester turned it back. Quietly and not ungently, she remained firm until Cynthia obediently opened her mouth and swallowed all of it.
"I don't like it," she cried.
"You'll get used to it. I'm staying here to give you this every 2 hours, all night long. You will get better if you obey." Hester did not praise, neither did she scold. She merely did not relent. And Cynthia took the medicine 2 hours later and cried again. The mother and Miranda stayed out of the room, although Hester had to have a conference with them in the hallway, telling them Cynthia would not live if they interfered and the medicine was not taken. So steady was Hester's trust in the voice of the Indian grandmother, she never doubted the ancient remedy. Not once. Chapter 23. When the mother dared to open her daughter's bedroom door late that evening, only wide enough to peer into the room unnoticed, she could not believe her eyes. Hester sat on the bed, cross-legged, leaning forward in the soft yellow light from the oil lamp. She was holding both hands up, her long tapered fingers spread with a length of string wound through them. Cynthia was following Hester's instructions, right then left, over then under, giggling. Her face was alight with the interest she felt. When the string was pulled and every intricate loop loosened in perfect symmetry, Hester clapped her hands. Cynthia squealed, bouncing up and down on the bed. When Miranda tapped on the door, the girl told her to come in, her eyes going to Hester's face, questioning. Hester nodded. The glistening dark face of the housekeeper was followed by the anxious white one of the distraught mother. They stood side by side, short and buxom, their arms pressed to their stomachs, their eyes wide with the wonder of the scene before them. Hester stayed the night, sleeping only a few hours on the chaise longue in the opulent bedroom. Precisely every 2 hours, she gave the child the bitter mixture, followed by an offering of milk or custard or thin sugar wafers, all of which she petulantly denied. In the morning, the fever had lessened noticeably. Cynthia's glassy eyes had returned to their normal blue, and her flushed cheeks were pale and smooth. With strict orders to the mother and Miranda, Hester warned of a recurring infection if the girl's earlier diet was not changed. She could have sweets only occasionally, and only after other substantial fare. Cassandra Breckenridge pressed a wad of bills into Hester's hand. The mother's gratitude was as outsized as the floral wallpaper, resulting in words of praise and flattery tumbling over themselves. Hester quickly put on her large black hat, as if to protect herself from the vanity that could so easily strip her of the humility and submission she was committed to. She was, after all, of the Amish faith and not given to vain words that blew oneself out of proportion, larger than truth. She pinned her black shawl securely about her shoulders and prepared to be driven back to the safety of Mulberry Street.
"You look like a witch."
This observation came from the bed where the child lay propped up. Laughing, Hester untied her hat, went to the bedside and kissed the girl's cheek. "I'm not a witch. I just dress Amish."
"I know."
As if to make up for the blunt speech, Cynthia threw her arms about Hester's waist, clinging to her as if she'd never let her go.
"Come back and see me, please,"
she whispered. Hester stroked the silky flaxen hair, her hand going to the smooth roundness of her cheek.
I will. I'll come to see you soon, and bring you carrots and turnips and parsnips.
Cynthia wrinkled her nose. Buppy was anxious, but resigned to the fact that Hester's comings and goings would eventually be a routine part of their lives.
After the Breckenridges, who knows what will happen? You better hope the bishops allow this. You know there are quite a few of our members who look on these old healing remedies as witchcraft.
Ugh, Buppy.
Hester shook her head as if to erase the threat of being unable to practice the use of her medicines.
I mean it. Look at the warning I got.
But I'm not on the town square hawking my wares.
Buppy cast her a level look beneath lowered lashes.
No, you just ride in fancy carriages with lovelorn grooms.
What does that mean?
Exactly what I said.
Hester's face flamed with shame. Her fault again. How could she ever stop this?
I'm sorry, she whispered.
Sorry for what?
That the groom was like that.
Buppy rose from her chair, her movement too quick, too calculated. She went to the window and peered between the wooden panes to the gray, wind-swept streets of the town. For only a moment, the longing, the dissatisfaction of being an older, single woman, barren and unnoticed, crossed her face.
Ah, Hester, dear girl, of course it's not your fault. You can't help that any more than a dandelion seed can help being torn from its stem and whirled away on fickle April winds. Only God knows where that seed will go and what will become of it.
I wish I was like you, Buppy.
Hester spoke harshly and fast.
No, you don't. You don't. You will never have to know what it's like to never be noticed, to never be asked to be someone's wife.
And you, Buppy, will never know what it's like to shrink within yourself when men look at you with that leering expression. I hate it.
Buppy only nodded. They sat together in silence, each protected by the solitude of her own thoughts. The fire crackled and burned. The steam rose slowly from the bubbling pot on the hook. Outside, a branch scraped against the wooden siding of the house. A brittle leaf was hurled against the window pane.
Think you'll always be a widow?
The words frightened Hester. Like being pushed off a cliff, she was being confronted by the yawning, unknown depths ahead of her. It was much too complicated to answer Buppy's innocent question. Failing to be a good wife, failing to provide William with sons and daughters, angering Francis, Hans, and Johnny, and their intentions gone awry, the puzzle was too difficult to figure out. And yet, she longed for something she didn't fully understand. She wanted the same kind of union she observed with Hans and Kate. That easiness, that toughness, the comfortable happiness. Was that kind of union possible only for special people like Kate? Likely. In answer, she shrugged her shoulders. Buppy nodded. Sighing, she said quietly,
Well, Hester, what say we cover the garden really well with about a foot of good horse manure?
And where do you plan on getting it?
From that cranky old Levi.
You mean Levi Bueller? Surely he'd want to spread it on his own fields, which are lying fallow at this time of year.
His wife is sick.
What's wrong with her?
Wouldn't know.
Bundled into heavy shawls, scarves, and gloves, they hitched Faithful Silver to the courting buggy and drove off down Mulberry Street, past the livery, the wheelwright, and the candle shop, into the open road that led away from the town. Everything was bare and brown and wind-blown. Every crevice was filled with leaves. Every tree branch, etched against the gray sky, moved back and forth, tossed by the stiff November breeze. Pieces of torn cornstalks whirled across the road, but Silver merely pricked up his ears and hopped across them. The straps on his haunches lifted, then fell with a flapping sound as he ran. An oncoming team pulled abreast. They both lifted their hands to wave at Francis and Elias. Francis's white face was hidden well by the sides of her great hat. Elias sat stiffly, his black hat positioned squarely on his head, the brim wide and flapping, his hair cut well below his ears.
Shoo! Buppy whistled.
She looked at Hester.
Your cap tied?
Hester meant to nod without acknowledging the pious severity of William's family, but a smile played at the corners of her mouth, tugging it into a reluctant smile and then a wide grin. Finally, she burst into a startling laugh that ended up being flung into the air, joined by Buppy's lusty guffaw, and whirled away. When they turned Silver into the uneven driveway that led to the Levi Bueller homestead, they had to duck their heads to avoid being smacked in the face by pine branches.
"He needs to clip these off. I'm going to tell him,"
Buppy said, swatting forcefully at the low-hanging branches. Hester had never seen a more beautiful pine forest. Thick and green and dotted with healthy brown pine cones, the evergreens were breathtaking. Redbirds flitted away from the women and hoarse with their saucy cries. Hester and Buppy came on to the set of buildings, all weathered and gray, but sturdy and not without charm. The house had a porch on two sides and dormers in the roof, which were quite ornate features for an Amish-designed house. The barn was built into the side of the hill, a sturdy bank barn made to accommodate wagon loads of hay and straw into the top bay. There was a neat hen house, reliable-looking fences in good repair, and a corn crib with a mended roof filled to the top. Silver flicked his ears and arched his neck when a sound, not unlike the baying of wolves, erupted from the barnyard. Immediately, a passel of skinny hounds came around the corner of the barn, their red tongues lolling, their eyes squinting from the effort of the incessant howling. They were so thin, every one of their ribs could be counted beneath their scruffy hides.
"Puh, anyone who keeps those hideous-looking dogs can't be too smart,"
Buppy snorted her disapproval as her eyes made a sweeping survey, sizing up the management of the farm, or the lack of it. She reached under the seat, pulled out the sturdy whip, and flicked it in the hound's direction.
"Go on! Shut up! Still!"
Hester shrank back as the tall form of an Amish man came from the house, his gait easy and lanky, as if he had all day to meet them. He snapped his fingers at the hounds, and they slunk away, looking balefully back at the visitors.
"What do you want with those ugly critters?" Buppy called.
Only Buppy, Hester thought. Amazed, she watched the Amish man adjust his hat, shift his toothpick, and smile broadly, looking directly into Buppy's eyes like a schoolboy and every bit as guileless.
"I make more money with them than I do with my cows," he announced flatly in a deep, rumbling baritone.
"Pah!
Sure I do."
"How?"
"Coon hounds, good ones too. I sell pounds of good quality furs. They tree a coon, he ain't gonna get away."
"Ain't he?"
Buppy said, punching Hester's side with her elbow.
"Nope."
Buppy changed the subject immediately.
"We want your manure, the horse manure. We need it for the garden. You told me we could have it."
The toothpick changed directions again.
"I did?"
"Yes, you did. Remember, you were at market."
"Can't recall."
Frustrated, Buppy said too loudly,
"Yes, you can."
Still, he had not noticed Hester, obviously enjoying Buppy's tantrum. Hester was delighted by the unusual banter. Levi was of medium height and wide, with a good, solid look about him. In a crowd, he would not have stood out. His looks were not striking. His hair was the color of dry brown grass, his eyes clear, his skin medium brown and a bit freckled, his beard unkempt the way most Amish men's were in the middle of the week.
"How's Martha?"
"The doctor's been out."
A cloud passed over his face, turning the clear eyes a stormy gray.
"And?"
Out came the toothpick. He lowered his face, threw it on the ground, and rolled it with the sole of his shoe.
"I'd rather not say."
"Why not?"
"You'll find out soon enough."
Hester swallowed. She sat forward eagerly. "May I visit her?" Finally, his attention shifted to Hester. His eyes appreciated her beauty in a friendly, offhand way, the way he'd view a pretty child or charming kitten.
"You may."
"Hester, no. We have work to do."
Whistling, Levi led the way to the barn. He hitched up two brown mules, attached the flatbed wagon, put Silver in a box stall, and fed him a generous amount of oats. Then he showed them the pitchforks.
"Do what you can today. I'll help you when I can. Martha needs me much of the time."
they pulled rubber boots over their shoes, rolled up their sleeves, and set to work, forking out the acrid, rotting manure, slapping it down on the sturdy, flat bed of the wagon. As soon as they had a load filled, Buppy hopped up on the wagon. Hester followed, standing beside her in the cold air as the mules lowered their heads and tugged dutifully at the wagon they were attached to. The gigantic ears flopped up and down as their heads bobbed. The traces jingled where the chains were attached to the single tree. Hester braced her legs, shifting her weight with the way of the wagon, breathed deeply of the cold, fresh air, and watched the flight pattern of a flock of snow buntings, flushed from the tall brown briars.
What's wrong with his wife? Why doesn't he want to talk about it? Why did he say we'll know soon enough?
Buppy shrugged.
She's pretty sick. I think it was Enos Troyer's wife, Salome, who said she heard she has cancer.
What's that?
Incurable. Nothing you can do.
Buppy's words were hard. How do you know?
Well, you can't. I don't want you to start with your potions and tinctures and herbs, all that craziness.
Startled, Hester's eyes flew to Buppy's face. She was alarmed to see an expression so painful it changed her features, twisting them into a caricature of Buppy's normally plain, unflappable demeanor. As if to ease the pain, Hester tried to change the direction of her inquiries. I don't remember ever seeing Martha in church.
That's because she hasn't been there.
Suddenly, Buppy turned to Hester.
He told me she's not going to make it. God only knows what that man has suffered. They had 3 babies. All of them died within 2 years from German measles. They say it got the best of Martha. She's never been right since.
Buppy's words were brittle, short, and thrown into the cold November day like rocks pelting against a tree, quickly, one by one. Ashamed then, Buppy turned her head to watch the brown grasses and the dead corn stalks trampled into the cold brown earth. A corner of her black scarf flew up into her eyes. Buppy grabbed it, stuck it inside her shawl, coughed, and cleared her throat.
Looks like we have company, Hester observed. Sure enough, in the grove of trees by the large garden stood a team of Belgians. The grinning Johnny sat on the oak boards of his wagon, swinging his legs, his hands tucked beneath him.
Well, well, imagine meeting you young ladies out here.
Buppy leaned back, pulling the mules to a stop.
What are you doing?
He didn't hear Buppy. His concentration centered completely on Hester, his brown eyes alive with interest, his teeth flashing white as he smiled broadly.
Hester, how are you?
I'm fine. Her words were clipped, firm, and without a trace of warmth. Buppy climbed down. Quickly, Hester took up the reins, chirped to the mules, and moved off to the center of the garden where she stopped the horses. Then she proceeded to pitch the manure off, flinging it across the garden with monstrous strokes.
Johnny shook his head.
She still doesn't like me.
Why should she?
Suspicious, Johnny turned his head and found Buppy's eyes boring the truth from his own. So she knew.
Cranky old maid. It wasn't my fault, he muttered.
Buppy's snort was loud enough to startle the sleepy Belgians. Johnny sighed, gathered up the reins, and drove away without a backward glance, his shoulders slumped in defeat. Buppy marched over to Hester's wagon, leaped aboard, and began heaving manure as if her life depended on it. The baying of the coon hounds heralded their return. Levi helped them load another heaping wagon load. They moved off through the pine forest, back to the garden, bringing more of nature's best fertilizer for next year's vegetables. They worked steadily without speaking. Hester felt the beginning of a painful blister on her third finger, so she shifted the position of her hand and kept forking manure. A line of dark clouds was forming on the horizon where the setting sun should have been. Like a curtain, it hid the sun's light. Hester shivered as the wind picked up, bending the grasses and rattling the dry branches overhead.
Too early for snow, Hester observed.
Buppy nodded.
You want to try for another load before dark? Hester asked.
We could finish.
Together they increased their speed, cleaning all the manure from Levi's horse stalls. He came out as they were spreading fresh straw. Hester led the horses back to their cozy pens, clean and sweet-smelling. Levi whistled his admiration in one long exclamation.
You did good,
he said simply. Buppy's face was red, as was her hair, strewn about like flames of fire. Her black kerchief had slid off her head, so she let it lie around her neck. Hairpins straggled from the roll of hair on the back of her head. Pieces of straw were caught in the unruly curls that stuck out everywhere. Her breath was coming fast, and she was laughing, obviously enjoying the challenge of getting the last load out.
Yes, well, Levi, we can't visit. We have to go. Looks like a storm's coming in the west.
Hester smiled at him, but he missed it completely. He was watching Buppy grab the leather reins and expertly maneuver the mules out of the barnyard, and at a competent pace down the rutted driveway until they disappeared out of sight beneath the pines. He stuck his toothpick back in his mouth, called to the coonhounds, and went to the house to tend to his ailing wife before he began the evening's milking. Buppy kept the mules at a quick trot, the traces bouncing up and down, the wagon lurching over the ruts in the road. Hester's eyes scanned the low bank of black clouds, tumbling and tossing now as they climbed higher into the sky. When they reached the garden, they shoved most of the manure off the side, then leaped off the wagon to scatter it efficiently. Overhead, the black clouds boiled and rolled. The first ping of ice hit Hester's nose as she lifted her head to watch the approaching tempest. "We're in for it!" she yelled as the wind slammed against her back.
"We'll live!"
Buppy yelled back. She lifted the reins, then brought them down on the mule's rumps with a high, "Yee-haw!" The mules lurched into a mad dash. Hester hung on to the makeshift boards that separated her from the mule's pounding hooves, her eyes wide as she watched the fury overhead. Ice pounded the galloping mules, bounced off the wagon bed, pummeled the women's heads, and pinged against their faces. Hester squeezed her eyes shut and held tight. She slanted a look at Buppy, astounded to see her standing upright, her eyes wide with delight, thrilled to be part of this dangerous adventure.
"Ouch! Ow!"
Buppy laughed as the ice hit her face, but she stayed on her feet, goading the mules over the rutted road. Hester was just about to warn Buppy about the steep incline when there was a cracking sound, as loud as the shot of a rifle. The mules were hurled to a standstill as the front axle broke, throwing both women from the bed of the wagon and into the wet, icy grass beside the road. Buppy screamed. Hester flew through the air, landed on her shoulder with a sickening crunch, rolled on her back and lay in the cold, wet grass, the ice still pinging on her upturned face. Her shoulder felt as if fiery darts were being shot into it. She squeezed her eyes shut and trembled from the pain. Gently, she twisted her head, shocked to see the mules standing still, obedient, the only movement the quick flicking of their ears. The wagon was slanted to one side in front where the axle had broken, severing the wheel. It lay in a heap of metal, the ice making dull pinging sounds as it fell against it. Hester heard a cry. She turned her head farther to see Buppy hobbling toward her, alarm bleaching her face to a chalky white.
"The mules, the stupid things! I never met a mule I liked! Hester, are you all right?"
Hester sat up and gingerly moved her shoulders. She winced, then grinned up at Buppy. "I'm all in one piece."
"It's these dummkopf mules, that's what,"
Buppy spluttered. Hester pointed. "Look at them, Buppy. Just look. They're standing there in the pounding ice, hitched to a broken wagon, dutifully waiting until we get ourselves together. You drove them too fast, Buppy. It was your reckless slapping that broke that axle." "Don't you go on about stupid mules, either. You should have seen Hans when our wagon upset when I was little. The horses ran off for miles with him floundering in deep snow after them. We walked all the way home without him. I still remember my mother dragging the blanket with Noah and Isaac wrapped in it while I watched the redbirds." Buppy's face changed color again, back to its normal deep pink.
"Well, how are we going to get Levi's mules back to him?"
Hester was already walking calmly toward the mules. "Unhitch them and walk them home. The next time, I'm driving." A gust of wind and ice tugged at her long, heavy skirt, but she kept on, resolutely unhitching the traces, remembering a time before
when life held only the wonder of a redbird in the pure white snow. Chapter 24. The haven of their homey kitchen was blissful as the ice bounced off the window panes and water sluiced alongside, dripping from the eaves and running down the sides of the sturdy German siding. Fire leaped and crackled. Sparks exploded up the chimney each time they added a chunk of wood. The room was warm, enveloped in a yellow, firelit glow. Sputtering candles on the table enhanced the coziness of their domain. They had put up Silver first, bedding him comfortably with fresh straw and giving him a good feeding of oats and corn, then putting down a forkful of hay. They latched the barn door carefully before checking in on Walter, Emma, and the boys. They found them in good spirits, chortling over a game of marbles as chestnuts roasted on a pan in the oven, filling the house with the nutty aroma of fall.
Kishta! Puppy had cried.
Oh, indeed, indeed, the finest nut of the forest, a delicacy!
Walter agreed happily, a tankard of warm ale at his elbow. The boys lifted their shining faces, elbows propped on the table, their shoulders hunched as they watched the game Emma and Walter were playing. With round cheeks, clean, smooth hair, and warm clothes, the boys were barely recognizable as the forlorn waifs who had appeared on their doorstep months before. Emma was as round as a pumpkin still. If anything, marriage only served to increase her enthusiastic appetite for good food, which was certainly not lost on her ample partner. Together, they bestowed all their generosity of spirit on the two lonely orphans who seemed to blossom like well-tended flowers. Hester wanted to stay. Walter and Emma's home never failed to fill a need, a certain yearning she had for the goodness of Hans's and Kate's home, and for her childhood, which they had supplied well with the nurturing that children require. But Puppy wanted to get home. She was cold and wet, with the same temperament as a hen in a similar situation. So Hester got up reluctantly and followed her back to their house. A hot, steaming bath, a pot of bubbling stew made of salt pork, potatoes, and dumplings, and the warm, cozy firelight all made Hester sleepy. She was content, thankful for all God had given her. She looked at Puppy reading by the fireplace, the German Schrift opened on her lap, her eyes dark and brooding, her thoughts a galaxy away. Conversation was not necessary at this hour. They were at peace. The hard labor of shoveling natural fertilizer onto the large vegetable patch had been rewarding. It was good to know when spring came that the rich brown loam would be full of nutrients, enough to feed the tiny plants shooting from the dropped seeds into tall corn stalks, heavy cucumber vines, hardy tomato plants.
It's not right!
Puppy's pain-filled voice shattered the peaceful atmosphere, slicing it in two like the thrust of an axe. Hester lifted her face, her eyes wide with surprise. Warily, she watched as Puppy rose to her feet, her movements swift. She slammed the Bible onto the table with a resounding thump, then propped her open palms on top of it, as if to derive strength from the bound volume of God's word. Hester opened her mouth to speak, but closed it when Buppy's anguished voice rose as she talked.
He's too proud. If he would only talk about her, I don't see how he can keep his wits about him. That's so often the way of our people. As long as he can make things appear normal from the outside, no one is going to inquire. I can't understand where his relatives are. He's so alone looking after that farm and caring for her. I don't know if the doctor has ever been to see her.
Who?
Levi.
Oh, you mean Levi's wife?
Yes.
A silence fell, with only the tiny hiss of a flaming candle to break it. Should I go see her sometime? Hester asked finally.
Of course not. It's not that she has cancer, which your greenery couldn't heal anyway. It's that her mind is... Well, she's like a child. Her good Verstand is gone. He has to feed her and dress her as if she were a child. I don't think very many people know how bad it is. She hasn't been to church for years. Hardly anyone goes to visit them. Now he has those coon hounds slinking around his buildings. I'm just afraid he's slowly going as well.
Hester winced at Buffy's mocking word, greenery. Quickly then, she shook it off, knowing it was only her forthright manner. Could we go visit, do you think? Buffy shrugged her shoulders, her eyes dark, hooded.
I'm afraid to,
she said soft and low.
Why?
Again, Buffy did not answer. The lifting and falling of those angular shoulders was her only response. Hail continued to ping against the windows. Hester shivered as she watched the rain run down the dark windowpane. She got up to put a log on the fire, stepping back quickly as the flames shot upward.
I just can't stand to think of Levi going through his days, never complaining or asking for help.
Hester eyed Buffy keenly. She had never seen her like this. She was always noisy, sure of herself, knowledgeable, voicing opinions without holding back, and joking easily and lightly. But now, quite unexpectedly, this miserable brooding. So taken up in the mystery before her, Hester did not hear the gentle tapping on the sturdy front door, closed securely with a large padlock against intruders. When the tapping turned to raps of a more solid nature, she held very still, her head tilted to one side. Buffy was so engrossed in her own thoughts, she did not suspect anything. Hesitantly, Hester partly rose, her hand on the plank table, her long, tapered fingers trembling slightly. Buffy looked up unaware. This time the rapping was harder, more urgent.
You go,
Buffy said. Biting her lower lip, Hester felt tingling in her nostrils, the acceleration of her pulse. Very unusual to have a caller at this time of the evening in weather like this. With a hand at her throat and a few light, soundless footsteps, she reached the door, inserted the key, and drew back the latch. The figure on the doorstep was tall, wide, and dark. Hester did not recognize him until he spoke in the deep, guttural voice of her people. The words were thick, as if he spoke through the swelled linings of his throat.
May I come in?
Quickly, Hester stepped aside. Oh, of course, forgive me. As he walked in, the smell of wet deerskin was overpowering. It was the rancid smell of the longhouses, nearly lost to her fading memory of the past. Her heart sank. His profile was startling. He was every inch the proud brave, the lineage of his ancestors, the Conestoga Indians running in his powerful veins. His hair hung sleek and thick, parted in the center of his head and braided with thongs of rawhide. Not a hair stood away from his forehead, so well had he applied the rancid bear fat. Hester swallowed. Choking sound rose in her throat. She put four fingers to her mouth to suppress the cough that would follow. Buffy stood, startled, as she placed a hand on the chair back in front of her.
Good evening,
she stammered, clearly at a loss for further words.
Good evening.
Turning to Hester, the Indian's deep, unfathomable eyes evaluated her.
I have returned,
he said. I see. I hope you are well, Hester said, her voice low.
I am.
Silence crept its uncomfortable way between them. Ill at ease, Buffy spoke too quickly and much too loudly.
Well, you're soaking wet. You're dripping all over the floor.
Puzzled, the Indian bent his head to see what Buffy meant.
It will dry. The fire is warm.
He stood closer to the fireplace, his back to the hearth, his silhouette a stance of power, of rigid restraint. His eyes sought and found Hester's face.
I, Hunting Wolf, have come before I planned. I can wait no longer. Before the snow comes, we will be in Ohio on the banks of the Great River. Here, there is much danger for me.
Hester put out a hand as if to stop his words. But...
You cannot decline my proposal.
Buffy stepped forward.
Now, just a minute here. You can't do this to Hester. She isn't ready to decide.
Like a rock, Hunting Wolf was immovable in his intent. Hester sank to a chair. The only sound was the crackling of orange flames as they licked greedily at the logs. She watched the candle flame dance, shiver, then resume its steady glow. In it, she saw the hills and fields of Berks County.
The log house nestled beneath the maple trees, the barn below it, the pathway, the split rail fence beside it. She could smell the pies and the bread that Kate baked in the outdoor oven, the homemade lye soap she used for washing, the air-dried clothing that she brought in off the clothesline. The sun played with the ever-moving shadows of the trees surrounding the cabin. The rain plunked on the cedar shingles of the roof when she lay, warm and drowsy, beside Lissy, with Noah and Isaac on the low pallet on the other side of the attic. The scrubbed wood floor, the sweet smell of raspberry jam on Kate's fluffy biscuits, the hard benches she sat on during church services, the beautiful rising and falling of the German plainsong. All of this was part of who she was. The smell of the Indian longhouse, the daily slaughter of small animals, the endless pounding of corn, sitting in dust, squatting by the fire, a stone for an oven, a turkey feather for bellows, the communal sleeping arrangements. Hester winced. To stand beside this noble brave, a proud specimen of her people, would be an honor. Had she been raised by her blood mother in the ways of her people, she was approaching her 30th year of living among the Amish, except for the brief time with the Conestogas. To live as they did was too foreign, too distant, a river that flowed too deep and too swift for her to ford. She knew the decision had already been made in her heart, for she belonged to the Amish, the plain way of life, the German heritage she had adopted as her own. In spite of the trials, here was where her heart found a home. Here in Lancaster County, working the fertile soil with Buppy, working among the poor and the wealthy, but using knowledge the Indian grandmother had passed on to her. The look she bestowed on Hunting Wolf could only be described as tender, sorrowful perhaps, but certain. I cannot go. My heart will remain with my people.
Your people are the Conestoga.
The Lenape.
You belong to us, the red man.
In blood only.
I want you for my bride. I desire you as my wife.
Hester lowered her eyes, her head drooping in shame. I have been a wife. You do not want me.
Yes, yes, I do.
No, I am not a good wife.
You will be among my people. We will teach you the way of the Indian woman.
Hester knew the ways of the Indian women. She had learned the communal ways, the squabbling, the boldness, the crude laughter. It was good in many ways. There was affection, love, and strength. Yet the culture divided so widely from her own. I would be honored to be your wife, but you will find an Indian maiden worthy of your love. I was raised among the Amish and wish to remain with them. I have no intention of marrying. Hunting Wolf sighed audibly. He opened his mouth as if to speak, then changed his mind. In true Indian fashion, he moved softly away from the fire. Going to Hester, he lifted her chin with his fingers and looked intently into her eyes. He spoke quietly, with great respect.
Then I can only wish you the best in the trail you have chosen. I have lost my heart to you, but I will not force you to leave your people.
Like a wraith, a wisp of smoke, he moved away from the kitchen, soundless. The only sign he had ever been in the room was the cloying scent of wet deerskin and bear grease. Quickly, Buppy hustled to the door, shoved the latch into the clasp, turned the key in the padlock, and leaned against it. Whew! She sighed. Heavily. Hester said nothing. Her hands were in her lap. Her fingers intertwined so tightly the knuckles were white. The set of her shoulders gave away the turmoil of her emotions, the pressured burden of making the decision in so short a time.
Buck up, Hester. You did the right thing.
Hester's smile was only a minimal lifting of the corners of her mouth, but it was a beginning. Slowly the smile widened, until it reached her eyes. When Buppy returned to the fire, their eyes met, and Buppy shook her head.
You did good, Hester. For a while, when you sat there like a rock staring at that candle, I declare you were every inch an Indian. Quiet, stern, commanding. I had a notion to get up and wave my hands in front of your face.
Hester sighed, a long sound of expelled tension. I guess my childhood with Kate as my mother is planted and rooted so deeply in my heart. It's there as sturdy as an oak tree. I will love her always. Everything I am, everything I do, I want to be like her. Buppy nodded.
As it should be. My mom is dead and gone, but she is the whole axis on which I revolve.
The silence that followed was very deep and comfortable, as the icy rain slanted against the cold, dark windowpane. In the spring of that year, Hester was filled with an unnamed feeling of sadness. In spite of the earth's renewal and the wonder of new life around her, darkness clung to her spirits as if her soul was mired in an unrelenting muck of despair. The dogwood trees flowered at Easter, and the daffodils and tulips lifted bright, happy faces to the strength of the warming rays of the sun. Everywhere, the grasses turned a deep green. It hurt her senses to lift her eyes to the hills as she dropped seeds in the rich brown earth. Her feet were bare in spite of the cold, damp soil. A blue short gown swirled around her ankles, a dull gray work apron flapping above it. She wore a kerchief of off-white muslin, knotted beneath the thick coil of glossy black hair. Tendrils of it blew in straight wisps around her forehead and down the nape of her long, slender neck. Her eyes were large and luminous, glistening with a strange melancholy that had deepened the light in them. She dropped one wrinkled pea seed at a time, her heart still, her lips compressed and songless. The butterflies and other insects failed to attract her attention. She didn't hear the bird song. Buppy was whistling, breaking into a ribald song occasionally, one that angered Hester. It was simply not a proper tune for an Amish woman, and one who was close to middle age for sure. Hester opened her mouth to speak her mind, straightening her back as she did so. Lifting one hand, she shaded her eyes against the strong sunlight and said, forcefully, "Buppy!" Buppy stopped, straightened, and lifted surprised eyes to her friend. She tilted her head at an angle, her eyebrows jumping in the most annoying manner. "That song is..."
"Oh, get off it, Grouch. Just because you aren't happy doesn't say I can't be. Stop pitying yourself."
Hester returned Buppy's glare, the black fire in her eyes popping and crackling. "I'm not pitying myself."
"Yes, you are. It's a beautiful day and a beautiful spring. God has granted us good health through the winter, and are you thankful?"
"Of course I am."
"Then act like it."
Hester dropped the seed she was holding, turned on her heel, and stalked out of the garden. Blindly, she walked away, faster and faster until she was running, her feet swishing through the tender new grass, her skirt swirling about her ankles, hampering her speed. Behind her, Buppy watched, lifted her angular shoulders, then let them drop. She shook her head from side to side and went back to dropping the pea seeds precisely. Hester would get over it, whatever it was. Hester ran effortlessly, like a deer, up a slope and through a grove of trees until she reached the top of a rounded hill. She threw herself down in the old growth of grasses, her breath coming in ragged gasps. She didn't cry. She had no tears within her, but only an ever-widening void, a darkness she could not hold at bay. She felt as if her life held no purpose, and the summer stretched before her as a long, dark tunnel of endless heat and hard work. Had she made the wrong decision? Should she have accompanied Hunting Wolf to his people? Her people? She tried to pray, but no words would form. She wasn't sure God would hear her prayers if she managed to speak to him. Alone, bewildered, she rolled on her back and opened her eyes to the intensity of the brilliant sunlight, the blue of the sky interrupted by clouds of white cotton. A shadow passed over her face. Startled, she opened her eyes wide. An eagle was flying, so close she could see the white feathers on its head, the distinctive curve of its beak, the great majestic wingspan, and the soaring motion as it propelled itself higher with the graceful lifting of its wings. Cold chills washed across her back and down her arms. Unbidden, Tears pricked at her long black lashes. She caught her breath as a sob tore at her throat. Leaping to her feet, she lifted her face to the eagle in flight. Flinging out her arms, she sensed the knowledge of God's love swelling inside her, filling her heart and soul with its warmth. So long ago, it had seemed. And now, a mere heartbeat ago, she had stood on the outcropping of limestone rock and felt God's presence as the eagle soared above her. God was here, on this Lancaster County hilltop. He was real, alive. He remembered her. He cared for her. Over and over, she spoke her praise, her face lifted to the eagle's flight, tears streaming down her face, her arms lifted in supplication. How long she remained, she didn't know. Finally, like a graceful swan, she folded her arms and sank to the ground. She rested in the peace that had eluded her earlier. Quiet, her soul anchored once more, she was filled with a new acceptance of her place in life. And gratitude for Buppy, for Walter and Emma, for her home and her work. Slowly, she got to her feet and began the trek back to the garden. She stopped abruptly when a figure emerged from the grove of trees, hesitated, then swung to the right toward Buppy working in the vegetable garden. Hester quickened her pace. She had no idea who the man might be, and it was better that Buppy not be alone when she saw him. Turning left, she broke into a run, taking a shortcut by slicing through the woods so she would reach Buppy before the man did. Breathless, she slowed herself to a walk. The pounding of her heart was stifling her. On he came, tall, immense, his shoulders wide, his body thick, straining at the seams of his clothes. Hester stopped to watch, mystified now. His gait was heavy, purposeful, the long strides covering the ground effortlessly. Where had she seen this gait, the set of those shoulders? Hester stopped, her eyebrows lowered in concentration. He was in full view now. His hat was brown and pulled low on his forehead. His face was barely visible, so low was the hat's brim. Hester was motionless, watching, her eyes taking in the familiar walk. Why was this man's gait etched into her memory, branded into her remembering? And yet she could not name him. He was a stone's throw away. She could not move. When he came on, she stood like a statue, her hands hanging loosely at her sides, her skirts blowing gently about her ankles. Her eyes were wide with bewilderment, her graceful neck held taut like the Indian princess she was. Did he smile first, or take off the hat that hid his features? She didn't know. When he removed his brown leather hat, thick, straight, blonde hair tumbled to his shoulders. His blue eyes were wide and filled with a light that was so glad. Hester lowered hers, shyness overtaking her. She began to tremble. Her knees shook as if a strong wind was threatening her strength. She drew a sharp breath. The plane of his cheeks, with weathered lines around his wide mouth, was so even, nearly perfect. He stopped. His eyes were fringed with lashes she had seen before. The cleft in his chin had been there before. She tried to speak, but could not utter a word. A hand went to her mouth. Slowly, he came closer. As if in a dream, he reached out, gently grasped her hand, and pulled her toward him. His eyes devoured her face, her eyes, her mouth, still as perfect in their symmetry as he had remembered. Her eyes were the dark jewels he had carried in his heart all these years. Their luster filled the emptiness in his heart. Twice, he opened his mouth to speak. Twice, he failed. Their gaze locked and held. When he spoke, his voice was low, filled with years of longing.
I am Noah.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Which Way Home, written by Linda Byler, performed by Stephanie Willis. Producer, Mike Charzik. Copyright 2016 by Linda Byler. Production copyright 2016 by Audible, Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible, Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.